You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this week's show concludes our month-long look at women in comics, with two interviews with female writer-artists who have produced very different kinds of comics, but ones that both mix form and genre to beguiling effect. Later in the show, I'm talking to Sally Ann Hickman about her self-published comics, which range from affectionate parodies of pop culture icons such as Spider-Man and the Powerpuff Girls, to intricate diary comics that give an intimate portrayal of the self-publishing world, packaged as collectible items with textured covers that incorporate fur, metallic sparkles, and googly puppet eyes. First, though, I'm talking to Hannah Berry, the creator of the graphic novel Britain and Brulightly, which tells the tale of a harried private detective with the nickname of The Heartbreaker, whose final case sees his career catch up with him in a terrific comic book that combines the tenets of noir with gentle surrealism and assured cinematic visuals. Both my interviews with Sally Ann and Hannah were recorded on location, so you'll have to forgive the sound of a cappuccino machine in the background of Hannah's and big band jazz playing in the pub behind my and Sally's conversation. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Hannah Berry, the artist and writer of Britain and Brulightly. I was reading an interview with you. You're a graduate of the illustration course in Brighton. So, on that course, had you been working towards doing comics, or had you just been sort of doing illustrations in general and then you decided that maybe working in sequential art and storytelling was the way to go?
I think I've mostly been, I wouldn't say working towards, I think I was always working on comics whilst I was doing the course, but I think I was more sneaking them in than working towards it. I think it was just a sly aside that I'd try and turn every project into a comic of some form or other, or at least sequential in some way, and then we'd get embarrassed and not show it to anybody, which was a good start. But that was it wasn't a master plan. It was just something that I always wanted to do. Well, that is a master plan really, but it wasn't an intentional one. It wasn't a conscious one.
Because you're now finding in this country specific courses, illustrating for comics, illustration for graphic novels. I mean, your peers on your course, what sort of art were they working towards? Children's books, graphic design, that sort of thing?
I'd say mostly graphic design. I think it's a bit unfortunate in that I think the course that I was on, they weren't really geared towards doing illustrations for anything as what was viewed as twee as comics or children's books. And a couple of friends of mine who've gone into children's books especially have felt really quite slighted. One of my friends, Emily Gravitt, she does children's books right now quite prolifically, and she does them very well as well. Not just, you know, she doesn't just do them. She's quite successful with them. But I think she was she finished the course in spite of the course rather than. Than because of it. I think I kind of felt the same way. I think it was just left me. I'm a bit ashamed to say it, but I was slightly embittered throughout the whole thing. But it did give me an incentive at the end of it to prove people wrong. I don't think people were saying anything against it. I think I left with the impression that it was not the way to go. It was not a good way to do things. It was certainly not very cool.
So the art in Britain and Brulightly, had any of that appeared as coursework, or was this a project you started after you finished the course?
Yeah, it was one of the projects in the third year. It was, I think we were given the brief to just go away and do anything which would fill a space in our portfolio and fill it out, fill a space, yeah. It was known as the space-filling project. and that's what I did.
Were the representatives of CAPE or any other publishers at your degree show perhaps looking for potential illustrators or graphic novelists?
No. I think it was every art student's hope that at the degree show there will be many powerful and important people that will turn up, because we sent out so many invites and we spent so much money on these booklets with all our samples of work in, and in the end I don't think anybody turned up, but it looked amazing if they had, but they didn't. In the end, I think it was my New Year's resolution to myself to send off what I had of the story so far, which was the finished manuscript and then the five pages which I had in my degree show, the five terrible pages which I redid, consequently. And that was, yeah, that was my project so far.
I mean, you know, you talk about the final book. Was that then something that you knew that you had in you once you'd done those five pages, even if you felt there was something that you had to redo?
Yeah, definitely. That was from when I started writing it. I thought this is all I wanted to do. And unfortunately, after I graduated, I mean, I was never really cut out to be a freelance illustrator anyway. I didn't have it in me. I wasn't a hungry illustrator. Yeah, I went on to I think where a lot of art students went. I went into offices and I worked as a temp and lots of meaningless jobs. But all the time working on the book still, and then eventually I managed to complete the thing and sell it on to Jonathan Cape, who were lovely enough to say yes.
Did Cape want you to complete any further art breakdowns or pencil roughs before commissioning the book? Or were they happy that your initial five pages and script showed that you had the aptitude to do the whole project in due course?
No, they offered me a deal based on that. I mean, it was kind of a tentative thing, but I think it was amazing at the time because I hadn't had any kind of proper, even remotely arty-based work.
Well, it seems quite a unique way to get into comics for an artist. In America, there are loads more publishers who print original graphic novels, but in the UK, it's almost unheard of for an artist to start off their career drawing a graphic novel for a major publisher. Did you get any advice from other practitioners of the medium?
To be honest, I don't know anybody else who's, or I didn't at the time know anybody else who'd gone in and done a graphic novel. I know a few people had done some self-published comics, which I tried to do and was just rubbish at. I didn't do very well in that either. But yeah, no, I didn't know anybody else who'd gone the same route. And I think I was just in the right place at the right time. I didn't know it could even be done. I just I had a look at the graphic novels on my bookshelves to try and work out what I was doing. And I settled on Cape and I think Vertigo. And I sent two pleading letters, one to each, and Vertigo said no and Cape said yes, which was really lucky.
I mean, I think it's a really terrific piece of work, Britain and Brew Lightly. And the presentation by Cape preserves the look of your painting on watercolour paper. If you hadn't been able to get it commissioned by a major publisher, do you think you'd have continued to render it in that style if you had to self-publish it on cheaper paper with less detailed reproduction?
I'd like to say that I wouldn't have compromised, that artistic integrity would have held out, but I think, to be fair, I just wanted something published. I wanted to finish this book and to have somebody take it away and print it. So I'd like to say that I wouldn't, but I probably would have let integrity go out the window and said, yes, print it on newsprint and turn it into black and white. I don't care. So it's fortunate they did. Fortunate they can. Fortunate that it can be printed so cheaply now, I think, as well. Although I don't like to think about... I don't know if there's any kind of repercussions with with child labour. I don't know. I'm not too sure about that. And to be honest, I don't like to think about that, just in case.
I read in another interview that you were a big fan of not so much original film noir, but what's called neo-noir, movies by the likes of the Coen brothers that take the tropes of film noir and then apply them to modern filmmaking. When it came to writing and considering the look of your first graphic novel, was neo-noir the style you planned from the beginning, or did it evolve as you went along?
I don't know, really. It kind of evolved. Actually, it sort of evolved by itself, because at the start the story was more... it was a lot funnier, I think, when I started it. It was quite a stupid story.
There's some good gags in there.
Thank you very much. But I think it just evolved that way. I mean, I'm really into films of, like you say, I don't really know if that's the proper phrase or not, but neo-noir.
Sounds like a good term.
Yeah, it sounded good, so I've started to use it. Maybe people will use it themselves. Or
but
perhaps they already do and I'm not aware of it.
One I came across is Film Soleil.
That's awful. That sounds like an ice cream. Yeah, oh yeah, the tone, certainly. I mean, I was really... I'm a really, really big fan of David Fincher and the atmosphere that he has in his films. They're quite bleak, and I think I quite like that. It's Well, they're just so atmospheric, yeah.
Reading Britain and Brew Lightly, I did wonder if Seven was a particular influence, as it's raining throughout that movie and it's pouring down throughout your graphic novel.
Do you know what? I hadn't noticed that until you pointed it out. Maybe I did copy on a subconscious level, but I'm going to say this, it was purely subconscious. If Mr. Fincher, if you're listening, I re-apologise, it wasn't intentional. Don't sue me.
Conversely, while the downbeat and sodden look of neo-noir is present throughout the book, there's also the presence of gentle English surrealism. I was wondering, where does, for example, Fern's partner, Stuart the Talking Teabag, come from?
Actually, that Stuart existed a long time before Fern did. It was in a comic which I did in art college in Basingstoke. And it was part of my final show for the course was another comic, and there were a variety of characters in it, and there was a character who was a teabag to amuse... It was just a character that was made up to amuse a friend of mine, because we spent less time in the studio and more time drinking tea on long, long, hour-long tea breaks. And so it was just to amuse her. And then later on, when I came back to writing the story about Fern, it just seemed so right that he should have this character, which was never really explained. It was something which was... it could either be an aspect of his personality that he saw as real, or an actual talking teabag, which, I mean, shouldn't be explained if it was. In which case, why is he not concerned that he's talking to this teabag? Which is still, it reflects, either way, it reflects on him as a character. And it just seems so appropriate.
Outside of film, what sorts of comics and creators influenced you as you were honing your style?
I'm really into French comics. There's a French artist who I really love called Nicolas de Cressy, or maybe de Cressy, I'm not too sure. I've got French lessons starting on Wednesday, so I'll let you know. I really love his artwork. His artwork is fantastic. I don't know if he actually worked on it or not, but he worked in the conception phase of Belleville Rendezvous, and some of the styles are very reminiscent of his artwork. The only thing is, as I mentioned, I don't speak any French, so his books that he's written, they could be amazing, they could be terrible, I wouldn't know. But the artwork is very, very nice.
Let's hope for that.
Yes.
Going back to film, though, one of several sections that struck me in your work as being influenced by film, in the way that perhaps other comics are not, is the scene where the lead character first meets the femme fatale in a coffee shop. And the stack of horizontal panels, they represent moments in time and include only bits of the waiter that's passing by, an elbow here and a foot there, which I thought was really interesting as it subliminally shows his presence. It's not something I've seen done quite that way in comics before.
I think, I think you might be right. Well, I think, I'm sure Chris Ware, I know Chris Ware does that, the mighty Chris Ware. Again, I didn't copy him. If he's listening, don't sue me. but I think I'm quite a fan of films. I'm quite a film geek. I'm not ashamed to say it. There's no shame in it. Although I'm a bit out of it recently because I've given up my job in Blockbusters, which is the lowest possible rung in the film industry. But yeah, that's as far as visual narratives go, I think that was the language which kind of came to my mind first and foremost. Whenever I came to a point where I was stuck on how to go from point A to point B, it was cinematic language which I turned to inevitably, for better or worse.
Another filmic effect that I loved in the graphic novel was the scene where he's searching the house and the cat walks in front of the narrative, as it were, which is something that you occasionally see in film, but rarely in comics, except when people are deliberately breaking the fourth wall.
I think as well, I don't think there's the attitude towards it that it can be so pretentious. I mean, if something like that happens in film, then people say, oh, that's so innovative. I think, well, maybe a lot of it, maybe I'm doing down my university course quite badly, because maybe it's come from that. Perhaps there was a large element of graphic design, and finding the best way to illustrate a point, not just in what you draw, but in how you draw it and how it's put together. So maybe I spoke a bit too soon. Perhaps it did teach me quite a few things. I'm still bitter, though.
Splash pages, where a comic has a single panel on one page for dramatic effect, are quite common. But in your book, you've got a quiet two-page spread after the climax, which was rendered in pencil or charcoal, perhaps, where both the audience and the lead character pause and reflect on what's happened so far.
Well, it was exactly that. It was something to break out of the moment. I think I was either fortunate or unfortunate. I had a big chunk of depression in the middle of making the book, and so I thought at least it's worked in a constructive way, and it made me want to I suppose, portray it in the book in some manner. And obviously, when it wouldn't quite work if it was exactly the same. There needs to be something to draw it out and make it more standalone. And having such a large expanse for it, it's quite cheeky in a way. it was cheeky use of depression to take up so much time over it.
Thinking about what we were talking earlier, mixing styles and media in your book, kind of reflects your interest in mixing genres as well. I'm assuming that's something you enjoy doing and something that comics lend themselves to very well.
It really is. It's fantastic, and it's something that's really fun to play around with. Especially the book that I'm working on now is a horror story, or a ghost story at least. And it's fantastic, because I've realised that, I'm a big fan of horror film, but one of the drawbacks of horror in film is that the audience has to see what the director lets them see. So if there's a monster creeping up behind Jamie Lee Curtis, then the camera has to focus long enough for the audience to see it. But in a comic, you can sneak something in the background, and you might notice it, you might not, but it's discovered on the reader's own terms, which I think it makes it more personal in a way. I think.
Considering Britain and Brew Lightly took you 3 years to complete, is the ghost story going to be shorter in length?
I tried to make it shorter in the same way that Britain and Brew Lightly was shorter, and it's turned out to be almost the same length. It's definitely going to be a smaller format. To make it neater, more personal, something you can take on a train and perhaps read, or take it on holiday, which you can't really do with the larger graphic novel.
And how far off is that from completion?
God, I think I'm still writing it at the moment. I'm not too far from the end of writing, I don't think, but I'm still writing, so I think there's a good couple of years of artwork, although I have now just given up my day job, so I'll be working on it full time, so it should be a little bit faster, I think.
I'm talking to Sally Ann Hickman. I was looking at your comics online, and the earliest examples of yours I could find was at a website called Cheese Comics, dating back to 2002. Was that the first self-published stuff that you did?
Yeah, university with some friends, sort of got together and just started making comics. And we went to Bristol as well in the early years, so it was loads of fun. One comic together that we took to Bristol, and it had different stories in by each of us, drawn and written.
It's a mixture of humour strips and also pastiches of existing comics. Now, you did a pastiche of a Spider-Man comic on there. You did a pastiche of the Powerpuff Girls, who are obviously hip at the time, and I'm not sure if anyone actually knows these days. I mean, was that because, as much if you're doing something as a calling card, if you use existing characters, then people can kind of see your take on it and realise that as a comics creator, you have a grasp of what's out there and also, you know, have your own unique take on it?
I think so, yeah. I've never really thought about it so in depth, but I used to love the Powerpuff Girls, and I think I really wanted an excuse to draw in that style. And the Spider-Man, when I look back at that now, it looks really creepy in a way, but I do love that story. I do remember when I was drawing it as well, the feelings I got from it.
What course were you doing at university? Was it an illustration course, and so comics kind of fed into it, or was it something entirely different?
I actually studied animation, so okay. I was sort of drawing cartoons I was drawing storyboards, and I didn't really think of them as comics at all, and then it was after university that I thought, actually, they are sort of comics in a way, in the sort of form that they are. But I didn't realise it for years.
I was reading a review of your work on the Forbidden Planet blog, and Richard Bruton compared it to Julie Duchesne. I think that's how you pronounce her name. What kind of artist would you say were your peers that you looked for as inspiration when you were doing comics? Because, you know, there is this crossover between comics and animation, but it is a separate language in its own right.
Julie Duchesne is one of my top favourites.
That's how you pronounce it.
Charles Burns, all the classics. I always look at... And at the moment, working in a comic shop, I'm just sort of looking at everything there is. Persepolis I read recently. That's really had a dramatic effect on me, I think. Yeah.
Because your stuff, it's a mixture of kind of autobiographical stuff and then more sort of abstract humour comics. I mean, how important is it to sort of tread a line between putting yourself wholly in your work in the sort of autobiographical stuff and then having things that are more sort of commenting on things that amuse you as opposed to stuff that's more personal?
I think if you know me and know my personality, I think that's what I am, really, sort of the true-to-life stuff, and then the silly things like the fried egg and the cherry cake talking.
And an aspect of your work that I think anyone who's bought a comic of yours over the last few years that's very prevalent is the handcrafted nature of it. That it feels very much like an artistic object, whether it's, I mean, I've got one of your comics here that's covered in fur and has eyes and what looks like a garter holding it together. And that's something that I think is very important to kind of self-published work, that it actually has some semblance of the artist's involvement, that you can actually feel that it was put together. You know, if it's a limited edition, then it should actually feel like the artist has put it together themselves.
Especially, I like it to feel like you're actually buying one of my diaries. It feels like the real thing in your hands, and that's what sort of draws you into it. So the intimacy of it, you want to look inside and see it. And my hands have been on it as well, so it's like a, I don't know what the word is, but it's been crafted by my hands, so it's reaching out to people.
And you work in a comic shop, but it's a fairly mainstream comic shop. I mean, do they have much small press stuff, or do you have to kind of like subtly tell the customers, well, if you enjoy this, then maybe you should check out the following?
They've got a small selection of small press things, but it's sort of kept away from, it is just the Spider-Man and the mainstream things that carry it on, really. But, you know, things can change. I might have my influence there.
Because obviously you are stocked in some of the more broader-minded comic shops in London. Yeah. When it comes to finding an audience, you've sold stuff on comic stalls, you know, in Camden Market. You've sold stuff at various conventions. Do you find that the different people who buy your comics vary enormously from the different places that stock them?
I think a lot of girls buy my work, majorly, I think. They see it, the glitter, the pink, the exciting things dangling off, the shaky eyes, everything. But I think other people have bought them as well. There's a gentleman that I've met every few years. He goes, oh yeah, I bought your comics. And I can never remember him, but he always says, oh yeah, this one, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so I guess it's quite wide, really. Kids always want to pick them up because of the way they look, but you can't say no because inside it's a bit more sort of for adults.
Have you purposefully done any special ones just for kids, so at least you don't feel like you're corrupting them by selling your comics?
I've done A Stinky Tale, which is a story about a dog that's especially for kids, because so many kids were coming up to me in conventions picking things up. I felt a bit, I don't like to gear things towards people, but I did feel a bit sad that they were missing out because they were, you know, wanted to read them.
And as part of a comics collective, you are a member of the Cheese Comics website, and recently you've been a member of London Underground Comics. How important is it to you to sort of have an artistic community to hang out with? I mean, I suppose, you know, at the very least you can show each other's work, and in terms of, you know, that there's new work being made, it's, I suppose, an encouragement, if nothing else.
I think it's the camaraderie and just going through the same things. We all know what each other's gone through, and staying up late at night and pulling your hair out, and then going to the printers and things not coming out right, and we all experience it, and we just know what each other's thinking, and what it gets, how you get to the end result, what you have to go through. It's good to be around everyone.
And a lot of small press people, yourself and other people, for example, at London Underground Comics, do autobiographical titles. When it comes to kind of like sharing your own personal history with people, is it also helpful that you know other people are doing the same thing? So maybe something you might find embarrassing, they think, no, it's okay, you know, it's not that shocking, and you're not revealing that much for yourself, because I suppose there's always an element of self-censorship going on.
Oh, definitely. I try not to do it, but you can't help it at all. But I do like to just put everything out there. I think I have done in some comics, maybe too much. I can't look at them when I go back. And if people ask me questions, I cannot bear it. I'm just like, no, no, I don't know.
I mean, your most recent project is called Sex, Drugs and... No, Socks... Oh, God, I've
Sex,
got it written.
Drawn and Rock and Roll.
Sex, Drawn and Rock and Roll. It's a great title. And that's up to four volumes now?
I've stopped doing it last year.
Okay.
I reached a point where I felt like it was becoming very samey every day, but I did start it again in September, so maybe I'll bring that out.
Because your story had kind of a beginning and a middle and an end in terms of that section of your life that you were dramatising?
I really didn't think of it that way, but I guess so, yeah. When you look back at it and read it, there is a beginning, middle and end, but I didn't mean it to be that way. But maybe also I felt that it was a good place to stop for a while and do other projects.
One of the projects that people can see imminently is, we were just handling it on a table recently, is Francesca Casavetti has brought out an anthology called BASTARDS for to represent a lot of your peers' work at Anguem. Yeah. I probably pronounced that wrong. And again, that's representing you as part of a collective. I mean, did you have a say in which pages of your work were being included in that anthology, or did Francesca say, actually, I like the following pages and these are the ones I'm going to include?
She asked me which ones I wanted to include, and I sent her some examples, and then she sort of suggested another one that I hadn't even thought of, and she put that in, as well as some of the other ones as well, which was good.
And what's the project that you're working on next?
The Wishing Well. It's a long journey to the Wishing Well and these children who make wishes, but they don't go how they want them to turn out.
Now, how many pages is that running to?
I think probably 100.
Wow.
Okay. It's my big masterpiece. I'm going to put it into smaller volumes so it's a workable amount and bring things out once at a time. I'm thinking of doing it in full colour as well.
Cool.
In a really sort of nice painted illustrative style.
And the first issue will be coming out?
Hopefully for the MCM Expo.
In a fortnight.
Yeah. But it might be just black and white for that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I'll look forward to seeing it.
For more info about Hannah and Sally Ann's work, please check out our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. As it's now officially the autumn, both in terms of the calendar and the weather, it means there are a variety of comic book festivals and conventions coming up over the next couple of months. This weekend is the British Comic Show at the Millennium Think Tank Centre in Birmingham, which includes guests such as Howard Chaykin, David Lloyd, Charlie Adlard, Duncan Fegredo, Sean Phillips, Hunt Emerson, Gary Leach and Alan Davis. More info at www.thecomicsshow.co.uk. October the 24th and 25th is the MCM Expo at the Excel Centre in London's Docklands, and that includes appearances by Andy Diggle, Jock, Lee Gallagher, Alan Grant, Ben Templesmith, Kieran Gillen, and last week's guest Emma Viacelli, not to mention various actors from the worlds of sci-fi, TV and film. More info about that at londonexpo.com. Also on Sunday, October the 25th, there's the Women in Comics one-day conference at Murray Edwards College in Cambridge, which includes Belgian-based artist Dominique Gobelet in conversation with Paul Gravett, Corinne Perlman and Woodrow Phoenix discussing autobiographical comics work, Helen McCarthy talking about women and gender roles in the work of Osamu Tezuka, and other talks by Sarah McIntyre and Asia Alphasia. More info about that at tinyurl.com/womenincomics. In November, Comica, the three-week festival of comics in and around the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, runs from the 5th to the 26th, and that includes appearances by Eddie Campbell, David Lloyd, Brian Talbot, James Jean, and Tara McPherson. More info at www.comicafestival.com. And finally, from the 19th to the 22nd of November, there's the Thought Bubble Sequential Art Festival in Leeds, and that includes appearances by Paul Cornell, Gary Erskine, Garen Ewing, Andy Diggle, Frank Quietly, and many more. More info at www.thoughtbubblefestival.com. www.resonanceradio.com. Next week, and for the rest of October, we're looking at anthologies and collectives in comics on the show, starting with Dickon Harris's interview with the creators and curators of the Banal Pig Landscape Anthology. And for more info about that and all of the various comics events throughout the autumn, please check out our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.